Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Today, I'm at Porter Square Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts, speaking with Marika Makula. Hi, Marika, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Marika, you are an illustrator, educator, and the 2020 New York Times bestselling children's author of Baba Yaga's Assistant. Your earlier book, Help Wanted, was published in 2009. You studied illustration, art history, creative writing, and ceramics at the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore, Maryland, and received your BFA in illustration in 2009. You went on to study creative writing and children's literature at Simmons College, where you received an MFA in writing for children in 2012. In addition to writing and illustrating, you are one of the owners of Porter Square Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which honestly seems like a natural progression for someone with your talents.
It was a natural path for me. When I was in undergrad, I started working with the local bookstore to design their summer reading. So I was putting together activities for a variety of different books. So each grade level would have a different read, but it was one, we'd get together and do one project that worked with every single book with all of the children. And so when I was in college, I developed that and ran it during my summers. And then when I finished undergrad, I ended up applying to Simmons and doing their MFA. And while I was there, I was working full-time at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, where I ran their children's department. So I did all the marketing, all of the buying, was on the floor, outreach, worked on a gift of reading program and a number of other things. And that was really where I learned everything there was to know about bookselling.
I would think one of those positions was a full-time job, let alone all of them.
Yeah, it was full-time doing that. And then also in grad school, full-time. So I was reading like 5 to 7 books a week. It was a very intense education.
Well, my hat goes off to you. But how did you end up at Porter Square Books?
So after a stint at the Odyssey, I was at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs. I was teaching at Skidmore College in their education department, children's literature for the elementary school classroom. And I also helped them set up and run their children's department at their new Saratoga store. And then after that, I moved to Boston, did a very brief stint at Harvard Bookstore. And then a friend of mine who also was the assistant editor on Baba Yaga's Assistant worked at Porter Square Books and said, oh, you have to hire her. So I ended up at Porter Square Books.
And you're a co-owner there, correct?
Yes. So in 2018, Dina and David, who owned the store, decided that they wanted to start seeing the transition of ownership to members of the staff. So anybody who was in a management role was offered the option of buying into the store. So the way it works is that from the profits every year, we basically get lent the money to purchase the store. So there's nothing up front that we have to pay out of pocket because booksellers do not have that kind of cash for the most part. But it also gives us the incentive of wanting the store to do well. And it means that our decisions directly affect our lives and the lives of our coworkers who also take part in those decisions. So it's a really lovely model. It does make for very long decision-making because there are 12 of us total. But it's also really great because you have a wide range of backgrounds, a wide range of ages, a wide range of experiences. And so we really get to discuss what happens with the store and how we're going to direct it. And I think that it makes it a much stronger governing body for that reason.
And what's the history of the bookstore? How long has it been around?
It's been around for a number of years because it actually has gone through a couple iterations of owners. So Dina and David bought the store, and then in 2018, this larger group bought it.
For indie bookshops worldwide, it's a struggle to exist on book sales alone. Porter Square Books has Cafe Zing. Is the cafe part of Porter Square Books, or is it a separate business within the bookstore?
So the cafe is technically a separate business within the bookstore. And so we work with them. A lot of the people who have worked there have gone on to be booksellers at Porter Square. So there's definitely a lot of camaraderie.
I'm sure it's nice for the staff and the customers to have a cafe within the bookshop. It's such a great draw. The Porter Square Books Foundation was created in 2014 with a grant from the author James Patterson. What is the mission of this foundation?
So the goal of that foundation is to foster a love of reading and books among children, especially ones in our local communities whose access is limited by economic or cultural factors. And so our goal is to basically, we'll bring in an author to a school, they'll do school visits, they'll talk directly with the students, and then every single student at the school will get a copy of the book. So they'll have a book to bring home with them by the author that they saw speak. We also try to think about like what the demographics are at a particular school and bring in an author that children can see themselves in to see that that is something that they can achieve. We work with local authors as well as nationally renowned authors who are not local and bring them in. Often if an author is coming to do an event at the store, we may also have them do an event with the foundation. So we do a number of different fundraisers during the year that are fun events, including our book prom that we use to raise money for that foundation.
Okay, so what is a book prom?
So at book prom, you bring a date that you abandon. So your date is a book, which you then abandon, and all of those books get donated to a local shelter. It's the YTY Homeless Shelter in Harvard Square. And we have author illustrators who chaperone the dance. So M.T. Anderson has been there. We've had a number of other authors, Raoul III, who does the Lowriders books. It's a lot of fun. We also do photographs. We have dances, the whole shebang.
That is such a fabulous idea. Well done. I love it. Now, I was taken with a page on the store's website titled, "So You Want to Be a Bookseller?" Particularly the words, and I quote, "No one gets rich in independent bookselling, but we offer competitive salaries, and booksellers who work at least 29 hours a week are eligible for our health insurance plan," end of quote. I'm impressed you offer health insurance for staff working 29 hours a week. Is this the norm offered at other bookshops?
So part of that has to do with being in Massachusetts, which has a very good health insurance program in general. And part of that has to do with the fact that we care very deeply about our employees. Like, we are employee owned. And, you know, providing that benefit is really important. So one of the first things that we were talking about when the shutdown happened in March was, how do we continue to pay all of our employees, even if they're not working? Because the store is not open, but we said we would be paying them for these hours that they're not working. So how are we going to do that? How are we going to make sure that if somebody is sick, they still have coverage and they still have the resources they need? So that was honestly the first conversation that we had, was to make sure that our employees were taken care of. And again, I think all indie bookstores really are community oriented and want to help their staff. They just don't always have the resources. And I think that one of the goals of Porter Square Books is to make sure that their staff are supported. And that is enhanced by the owner manager situation. But I think it also just shows who owns it and the values that we have.
And when the pandemic hit us, did you kind of divvy all of the different jobs that had to be done very quickly, such as scheduling virtual events, making sure your e-commerce site was strong and could support the amount of sales coming through? In other words, gave everyone specific jobs where their interest and strength would be best used.
Yes, that's exactly it. So all of our events are virtual and will continue to be for the foreseeable future until we feel comfortable having in-person ones again. So yeah, when we went into shutdown, it was figuring out, you know, we didn't have enough staff trained on how to do online orders. So a lot of it was figuring out, how are we going to train staff? How are we going to get laptops loaded with the correct software to staff? Who can actually be in store to fulfill things? I generally run school book fairs, and all of a sudden that didn't exist.
Oh my goodness.
And so a large part of my job was saying, okay, I have all of this background experience in different roles at other bookstores. What can I step in and do? Where can I help? What is my role in this? How do I figure out what that is? And so a lot of us just had to pivot and figure out what the new role was, what our systems were going to be. And it was difficult in the beginning. The website platform that we use is one that many independent bookstores use, and it is not intended to handle that sort of capacity. And so it was figuring out, how do we make this easy for our customers, especially since we do have a lot of older customers who don't want to place online orders. So how can we still make sure that they're getting the books they want, especially when they're stuck at home.
And how did you end up working that out?
We had a number of different systems, some of which was phone calls, like phone calls were being forwarded to cell phones. Some of it was just kind of training people how to use the website and trying to provide as much support as we possibly could. Luckily, right now we are doing curbside pickup and we do have some in-store hours, but even when we were only doing curbside pickup, if you really had to, you could sort of like stop by the door and we would make something work. If it was somebody who really couldn't manage it. And then like also stepping up of local community members, there are a lot of people who are picking up books for elderly people that couldn't leave the house, or, you know, placing the orders and having them shipped to friends. And we've been doing shipping the entire time locally, as well as we've done local delivery, with the idea that we don't want our booksellers exposed. So anybody who wants to stay home and get their books received that way, like, we are happy to do that because we want to keep our staff safe.
And has the ABA been helpful? Have you had support from them during this crisis?
The ABA has been helpful. A large part of making sure like the website was working the way it needed to, that's all done through Indie Commerce, which is part of the American Booksellers Association. And then they also send out weekly emails. They were doing a lot of coffee hours where they're talking about resources that we could have, information about the PPP loans, things like that, that were coming from them.
Was it a headache and time consuming figuring out all of the paperwork and doing all of the paperwork for the COVID relief options for the business?
Yeah. So we're very lucky. And one of the original owners is a lawyer and he took care of all of that. Like, he was absolutely incredible. So we did get funding that way, which was a great help in making sure that we paid all of our employees for hours they were scheduled to work, even if they couldn't work them.
Well, that was a double relief. Now, I'd love to hear about your booksellers. Do they each have an interest in a certain genre?
So yeah, so we actually, there's an entire page on our website that profiles all of the booksellers, along with links to their staff picks. So every month we have staff picks for adults and staff picks for kids where we highlight books that we love. We also have been doing a virtual bookseller since you can't come and have us hand sell in person. And that circulates to all the staff. So when you do that, you get recommendations from everybody. We definitely have people who specialize. Like, Josh is an amazing reader of translated books and also very weird literary fiction. So like, you know, he's a go-to for certain things. We also have a number of authors on staff. And so they're really good at recommending things that they know very well. We also have people who are nature readers and tend to focus on that category. We have people who are mystery readers. We have some lists online very specifically for like queer authored sci-fi fantasy. So we really enjoy making niche lists that everyone can sort of add to. So we have this sort of brain trust going on. But then we also do have customers who know the bookseller that can recommend to them and will come in and buy that person's staff pick every month, or say, okay, what is this person recommending? Because I know I need something from them.
Booksellers are wonderful, wonderful people and very good at their job. Now, Porter Square Books offers book clubs, book fairs, and online events. What is the Prison Book Program?
So the Prison Book Program was set up through another organization. And so the Prison Book Program basically creates lists that of books that they think are needed, and they do a lot of outreach and work with prisons. And so they sent us a book list and then we posted it on our website, and anybody is welcome around the country, around the world, to purchase books off of that list. We process the order and we work with the prison book donation. They actually come pick up the books and get them to where they need to be. So for us, it's a great way to be able to offer a way to donate to the larger community, to our customers. A lot of people in Cambridge just really want to help in any way that they can. And some of them have the means to do so. And so the Prison Book Program is a way to do that. And we're really happy to be able to offer it. We also offer, we partner with the Cambridge Public Library every holiday season. And we do a book drive for kids locally. So this year that was an online list as well of books that could be purchased and then donated. And then early on in the pandemic in March, April, and May, we also donated a ton of books to the local schools. So they were handed out with the free meals that were being handed out to kids who needed them, so that they could have activity kits and novels to read, as well as their lunches.
What I love about what you're saying is that you help the community and the community supports you when you need it too by buying books. And speaking of community, can you tell us about your Writers in Residence program?
Oh, this is a great program. So unfortunately, it's been a little, we weren't able to offer it this year because we can't have a writer in store. But because there are so many writers on staff, we wanted to offer the bookstore as a place not only to write, but also to have access to some resources. So we put out a call for both a children's writer in residence and an adult, got submissions. They were reviewed and read by staff members anonymously. And then we selected somebody who could then work on their book in store. So you have access to our back office on nights and weekends. You can sit back there and actually write. A discount on books, so they get the staff discount as well, which is always nice. A discount at the cafe as well to stay nicely caffeinated. And then they also get the chance to do readings, to introduce authors, to write blog posts. So it's a way of sort of putting yourself out there and having more of a platform, as well as getting a chance to talk to authors and interview them, and also the space to work on your work, which I was the recipient of a fellowship at one point where I was provided with a desk.
What a great way to support local authors.
Especially with city living, when you can be living in such a small place, just having access to a desk and to a space that is not your home can be an incredible experience.
Now, our listeners are from all over the world, and they love to hear about the geography and just the setting where a bookstore is located. So could you just give us a little tour of Cambridge, please? Because you've just said it's really crowded.
So it's crowded, but it's mostly like three-story houses, some of which can contain 3 to 6 apartments, and some of which are stately one-family homes. The biggest thing I think Cambridge is known for is just the number of colleges within it. So Lesley University is right next to the store. Harvard University is not far away. MIT is also in Cambridge.
That's a lot of colleges in one area.
Exactly. And so we have a lot of retired professors and academics on staff. There's also a lot of people who work in tech and biotech in the area, just because that's what's located here. So a lot of people who are engaged and driven people. In terms of what the city streets look like, you have these three-story houses for the most part. There's lots of trees. There's lots of very tiny parks that are sort of hidden amongst the streets. The streets tend to be windy and confusing. It is very difficult to figure out directions in the city. And I would say it's spotted with little free libraries as well, which is lovely. There's a lot of people who cycle to get places and a lot of people who walk to places. To get places, it's very pedestrian friendly.
One place I would love to go. I've not been able to get there yet. Now, did you get a lot of snow this year?
We didn't get a ton of snow. There have been years where the streets were impassable and it was really difficult to get around. But this year has not been a heavy snow year.
Marika, is there one book, apart from one of your own, that you'd like to see more people reading?
So one of my absolute all-time favorites, and it's not just mine, it is beloved of a number of booksellers at the store, is Braiding Sweetgrass, which is this beautiful look at, the best way to put it is nature, but it's so much more than that. It's a book I want to give to everyone I know. There's a revelation on every page. Suddenly, like, you're looking at the world from a slightly different angle or from a step to the left or right. It's written by an author who is First Nations, but is also a biologist. And so she basically takes Indigenous wisdom and also science and talks about how they're connected and how they support each other. And her language is beautiful and poetic.
And what's the author's name, please?
Yeah, it's Robin Wall Kimmerer. There's an anniversary edition of the book that just came out that is illustrated with woodcuts and is absolutely stunning. And I highly recommend the book. It's a book that I bought 5 copies of and just hand to everybody I know, because I think it's an important way of reconsidering the world around us and thinking about how we want to exist in the world and what we can do to help the environment that also supports us.
And is it a book of short stories, narrative nonfiction, or done in a fictional style?
So it's narrative nonfiction. It's written as each chapter sort of stands alone as an essay. And some are more personally based. Some are more about scientific research that she's done. And so you can even like pick and choose chapters and read the ones that resonate more with you.
Sounds like a great book to hike with or just to have with you so that you can pick up the book and read a chapter. And speaking of books, can you tell us a little about your writing and the books that you've had published?
Yeah. So my first published book was Baba Yaga's Assistant, which was published by Candlewick, and the paperback came out about 9 months ago, which is exciting. And I actually wrote it during graduate school. It was my thesis. And then sold it to Candlewick Press, which was an absolute dream.
Congratulations.
Makes me very happy. It's middle grade. I love writing for middle grade because there are people who still have a sense of wonder about the world. Like, you're not going to tell your best friend that you think Narnia exists, but you're still going to try the back of the wardrobe just in case.
That is a perfect metaphor.
And there's a sense of wonder and magic in the world that hasn't quite been pushed out of you by society yet. And I think that's really delightful. I also think that there's something about middle grade where it's very true to who you will be in the future. Like, you're going to go through your teen years and you're going to try a lot of crazy things out and life is going to be weird. But eventually you might return to those like strong traits that you had when you were a kid.
And let's talk about the illustrations and the style of the book.
Yeah, so it is a graphic novel, illustrated in comics. So the entire story, I had to write what's called a graphic novel script. So you describe every panel and how many panels there might be per page and where all the page turns are. Because the page turn is really important in an illustrated book. It's all about what is going to be revealed when you turn that page. And then you also write the dialogue. And then the illustrator reads that. Sometimes they'll adjust some of the panels a little bit. Sometimes they might change things a little to adjust the mood or make sure it's really where it needs to be. And then they use those directions to basically make the illustrations. And it's really exciting. For me, it was working with a collaborator is wonderful because they bring something to the story that you didn't even know was there.
And who illustrated your book?
So I was very, very lucky. And I got to work with Emily Carroll, who is an award-winning illustrator in her own right. And Candlewick picked her and I immediately said, absolutely, this is a dream come true. The illustrations are absolutely delightful.
And would you like to give a shout out to any of the other authors who work at Tortoise Square Books?
I would love to. So Rebecca Kim Wells is one of our booksellers who mostly specializes in children, but reads very broadly as well. And she's written a number of YA books, and she has one coming this summer as well. And then Josh is also one of our booksellers, and he has a adult, very literary mystery, which is also available at the store. And if you go on the store's website, we actually have a link to local authors because there are so many of them. So you can order signed books through us, including books by our staff members.
Marika, it has been lovely chatting with you. And before we sign off, is there anything you'd like our listeners to know, especially those in your own community?
I mean, I would just say that the store as a whole really loves our community. And especially through COVID, we've just felt so cared for and appreciated by our community. And that's really what we're about. And really what keeps us going and innovating in the store.
Yes, and when we support our local indie bookshops, they're going to be there when we get to open up fully again, which hopefully is in the near future. One final question, is Porter Square Books signed with Libro FM?
So we do Libro FM. Personally, a lot of staff members absolutely love it. And so we do recommend books on that all the time. I think the audio listening experience is wonderful. Right now, we can't necessarily have driveway moments if we aren't commuting, but I've had run moments where I keep running just to keep listening. So I totally understand that.
Do you mainly sell books from your own e-commerce site on your website, or are you also signed with bookshop.org or IndieBound?
We do, but mostly we get orders through our website directly.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come and chat with me and for being on the Bookshop podcast. It's been lovely.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
If you'd like to support the ongoing episodes of the Bookshop Podcast, you can go to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com, click on the little orange heart on the top right of the page, and you can donate using PayPal. Donations support my time in research, editing, producing, and marketing the podcast. Thank you so much. All donations are appreciated. From bookshop to author. Fran Hawthorne spent 3+ decades writing award-winning nonfiction, including 8 books, mainly about consumer activism and business social responsibility. Her book, Ethical Chic, The Inside Story of the Companies We Think We Love, was named one of the best books of 2012 by Library Journal. In addition, she has written regularly as either a staff editor or freelancer for The New York Times, Business Week, Newsday, The Scientist, and many other publications. Fran's first novel, The Heirs, follows Eleanor Ritter in her obsession to confront the secrets her mother has carried about how she survived the Holocaust in Poland and ended up in New Jersey. Hi, Fran, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and congratulations on launching the podcast.
Thank you. You graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, with a BA in English, and you wanted to write stories. However, you ended up at the Daily Cal school newspaper. Do you consider your journalism background an asset to your ability to research and compile information?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a great skill I've had. And this, my novel, The Heirs in particular, required a lot of research. It's about, I what I call second generation Holocaust guilt. There's a mom, a soccer mom in New Jersey. Her mother, and they're Jewish, her mother has refused to talk about how she survived the Holocaust in Poland until suddenly, as the book opens, she breaks a hip and starts talking in Polish. And meanwhile, this soccer mom's son is on a team and becomes friendly with the little boy whose parents are Polish Catholics who were born and raised in Poland. And so the soccer mom, Eleanor, becomes obsessed, dually obsessed, with getting her mother to talk and with, in essence, getting this Polish woman to talk. And so what did your family do during the war? And so it required research into not just the survival, how people, Jews, managed to survive in Poland, life in pre-war Poland for Jews, life in post-war Poland for Catholics. What were they taught about the war? Polish food. So I live in New York City, and there's a part in Brooklyn, a Polish enclave in Greenpoint, like sort of Little Warsaw. So I went there and I sampled all of the Polish desserts that I mentioned in my book. My journalism skills didn't help on that, but they did help in medical research. The book begins with a broken hip and an elderly woman. There's 2 other major medical issues that come up. There's one character is an artist. I'm not an artist. I had to research certain aspects of being an artist and the materials you'd use. So my journalism, I probably went overboard because, you know, when you're a journalist, you darn well better not get anything wrong. And so I amassed far more research than I needed. I read dozens of books. I went to Poland. I talked to Holocaust survivors. I talked to artists. I talked to doctors. I went, online to all these archives on all these details because I just didn't want a reader to say, she's got that wrong. I'm going to throw it out. And I learned wonderful things about how before the war, Jews and Catholics in Poland would work together in the fire departments, for example. I mean, very fascinating things. I also learned a lot about Polish anti-Semitism before the war, and it was horrible. So I'm grateful for the skills I had, absolutely.
And you've done a complete 180 with your latest novel, The Heirs. How do you feel your previous 5 nonfiction books on consumer activism and business social responsibility prepared you for the dance of writing a fictional novel?
Well, it certainly helped because I understood a bit about how the book publishing industry works after a career in magazine and newspaper publishing. I understood about proofs and marketing. I was worried that journalism would make me unable to write fiction in a way. So I've been writing novels since I was a little girl. They didn't get published, but I wrote them. And there's a couple of them I look back on are pretty good for that age. Anyway, so when I got to college, to Berkeley, as you mentioned, I was always going to write novels. That was going to be my career. And I figured I'd earn a living as an English teacher. And believe me, the world is much better off. I would have been a terrible teacher. So I don't have the patience. Oh my God, teachers, they're saints. And especially now with COVID and trying to do it online, and I would not have been a good teacher. But anyway, so a roommate said to me, if you like to write, why don't you try out for the newspaper, the Daily Californian? And I was horrified. I said, ooh, hack writing, journalism, you know, I'm an artist. But I went and I got an assignment and I loved it. And I did a good job, got hired on the staff. And so then I was hooked. And so off I went on my journalism career. And somehow, all those that say, well, I'll work on my book at night. Well, after all day of writing, I want other things in my life, and I didn't work. So, but I guess I never lost that spark. Plus, as I got more and more experienced and I started experimenting with other kinds, I went from newspapers to magazines, and some of the magazines encourage more creativity. Telling the story is a narrative, because often very good magazine articles are narratives, they're stories. Getting more descriptive, the scene, the characters. Even the first of my nonfiction books, The Merc Dragonaut, I allowed myself even more freedom. And the editors were fine. They didn't say, this is not objective. So, you know, I would describe people. I would put in anecdotes. So I was getting increasingly more like fiction anyway in my nonfiction. And I was always telling stories to myself. That's the other thing. If I'm thinking about someone I'm going to be meeting tomorrow, I invent five different scenarios in my head, you know, what could happen. And that's fiction. That's writing short stories in my head. So that when I sat down to write The Heirs, it just happened. I didn't start to write who, what, when, where, why. You know, I didn't start to write a newspaper story. I started writing a novel. I mean, look at the first chapter, and there's Eleanor and Kate, you know, they're cousins, and they learn that Eleanor's mother has injured very badly, you know, broken her hip, and suddenly started speaking Polish.
And it's a wonderful first chapter, by the way. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And Fran, what about the stories you wrote as a child? Do you still have any of them?
I don't. You know, not only were there all the moves when I was a child, but as a grown-up, I left California, came back east, although I came to live in New York where I had never lived as a child. But anyway, all my many, many moves, no, I was looking for them. After I finished writing The Heirs and was trying to get it published and mulling over what's my next book, because I'm never going to not be writing a novel. And there was one I actually wrote in my 20s that I almost got published, actually. There was an editor who loved it. So I wanted to find that and see if I could resurrect it. I didn't have it.
The question asked in the synopsis of The Heirs is, how many generations does guilt carry on? What did your grandparents do to my grandparents? I find this topic of maternal and paternal patterns being repeated fascinating, and one that is raised for women over the hurdle of their mid-50s. Some look at their lives and consider their disruptive personal patterns or triggers and wonder if the pattern is bound in their scarred emotional DNA. What are your thoughts on this?
There's some of it we can't control, I suppose, and some of it we try to fight against, you know. I see the things in me that are like my dad, that, I mean, he's wonderful, I love him, but, you know, that I wish, right, maybe I would tone down. The other thing, it took me only until 3 weeks ago to realize this. I mean, all my life I hadn't thought about it. My dad, if you think about it, he's a kid, and he's yanked out of Poland, and arrives in the United States where he doesn't speak the language, right? This happens to many, many children. The shock and the insecurity that ought to have bred in him, although, you know, he's not an insecure person, but what does that do, you know, to you? And you would think a person like that would say, well, I'm just going to settle down, I'm going to have my patch of land, and I'm going to stay here. And my dad didn't do that, quite the opposite. He was an electrical engineer, and so in the 50s and 60s, you know, the height of the space program, we went back and forth. We lived in one, two, three, four, five, seven different towns by the time I was in fifth grade. Clearly, this didn't make my dad want to settle down.
Or one could look at this and say, well, perhaps it made him restless.
He definitely was a restless person, psychologically, but also it was all seen in those times as career, you know, better career moves. Or sometimes it would be like we moved to California and rented a house first, and then we bought a house. His job didn't change, but you know, the same thing happened in Massachusetts. You know, he got a job there. We rented and then moved to another town. But so years later, like when I was in my 20s, went to therapy for the first time, and my therapist said, well, that must have made you insecure. And I said, really? Never occurred to me. And I was, my God, yes. That is a very defining aspect of my life.
And did you end up at Cal Berkeley because of all the relocating?
Right. We ended up, our final stop after all those moves, we stayed in California. And so when it came time for college, I wanted to go to Radcliffe, because the place we had lived before California was Massachusetts. And I wouldn't forgive them for dragging me out of Massachusetts. And I wanted to go back. And they said, we pay taxes to support the University of California. There are 9 good campuses. Choose one. So tell me something. If you lived in Los Angeles, where would you go if you wanted to, and you had to go to one of the UCs, where would you go to get as far away from your parents as possible?
Berkeley.
Exactly. And it also was an excellent school. It was considered, I don't want to insult the others, but it was certainly considered one of the top two. It considered itself the top one. But so I was glad, you know, and as I'd got, you know, worked on the Daily Californian. And anyway, so that's how, that is how I ended up there.
Well, we're talking about family. Your father, his parents, and sisters got out of Poland less than 2 years before Hitler invaded. Did your father and grandfather talk about this time in their lives, or was it not something that was discussed? And what are the semi-autobiographical elements in your novel, The Heirs?
So my dad did not talk much. As I said, he's kind of a guy thing, maybe, you know, back in those days. He told us a few stories. My one aunt was 4 years old, and she didn't even tell her kids much. She just didn't. One of my cousins talked a lot to my grandmother. Why didn't my sister and I ask more questions? It's a good question. I regret it now, because we grew up with it. It was a known fact. Okay, we're lucky they got out, because then I was too busy being a rebellious teenager. I'm kicking myself now. But, you know, so then when I started writing The Heirs, my other aunt, I interviewed her at great length, and she was so delighted to talk to me. And there's a couple of her stories, in fact, that are small bits. There's a birthday party that's in The Heirs where the grandmother, who was then a little girl, Ruja, she goes to this party, and all the other little girls are Catholic, and they turn on her and they call her a dirty Jew. And that's exactly what happened to my aunt, for instance. Thank you, Aunt Lillian. I'm stealing your stories. And then my cousin, I talked to my cousin at great length and got some of my grandmother's stories. And a changed version of one of those is in the book, too. My grandfather was basically the doctor in this town. There was another doctor, 2 doctors in this small town. And so they were kind of important people in the town. And there was apparently a ball, and they went, my grandmother and grandfather, and no one would dance with my grandmother because she was a Jew, until the police chief danced with her. And a few days later, signs appear in the town, list of Jew lovers, and the police chief is among them.
And what year would this have been?
Right, I don't know exactly, but maybe 35, 36, 37, around then, when the anti-Semitism, it's a historical fact, got a lot worse. Before Hitler invaded, believe me, they didn't need Hitler to teach them anti-Semitism, which, okay, here's a rabbit hole for you, and I apologize, but so I tweet, as we all do, right? And when I hashtag Poland, hashtag Holocaust, you know, I get bombarded by these Holocaust-denying Polish trolls, you know. The anger, the hatred, the denial, it's astounding. So anyway, to go back to my story. So I got a lot of stories from my cousin, you know, via my cousin from my grandmother. But the book is definitely not autobiographical.
A few snippets here and there, but how can you not use such wonderful stories as the one you just shared?
Yeah, a few anecdotes, because the main difference is in the novel, There's the grandmother, Ruja, who was 12 years old when Hitler invaded, who survives somehow, comes out, comes to America. This is not giving away any secrets. She's the only one. Her parents, her little sister, her little brother are all killed. Her older sister had already come to America. Well, my family, no one survived. They either got out early, like my father, my grandparents, my aunts, or they were murdered, like my great-grandmother, my great-aunts, second cousin, great-uncle. So that's a huge difference, because that's one of the hearts of the book, as well as all the other subplots.
And what was the inspiration in getting started and writing the book?
The book was inspired because when my son was in first grade, there was a little boy in his class whose parents were Polish Catholics who were born and raised in Poland. And I had that knee-jerk feeling. What did your parents do in the war? But the difference is I only knew them to say hello and goodbye. In this book, the main character, the mother, you know, Eleanor, gets to know this Polish mother and becomes, as I said, obsessed with her and obsessed with her story. And more importantly, obsessed with what her parents did in the war. And so that's totally made up. And then all the other subplots, the Eleanor, her marriage is troubled, her husband's never around, she starts flirting with the soccer coach. I haven't never cheated on my husband. Never came close. You know, I want to make that clear. We novelists, we have to have imagination or books are really boring.
And in 2014, you visited Poland. Was this your first trip? And did you feel any familial pull?
It was absolutely my first trip. My cousin, she and her husband are rabbis, and they had arranged a sort of group for their synagogue to go to Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland, and invited me to join, which was wonderful. And then my cousin and her husband and I stayed an extra day, but I'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, so when we're on the tour bus and I just started screaming, oh my God, we're in Poland, you know. It just hit me. As in all these countries where you would go to the site of a ghetto or, you know, Theresienstadt or Auschwitz, you know, you're imagining the Jews there. Oh my God, how can you not? But when we stayed that extra day in Poland, we hired a tour guide and we had maps and addresses because my father had gone back to visit. My aunt, the one aunt, and not the one I talked to, the other aunt, and her husband had taken their kids and gone to visit. My great aunt had gone to visit. So we had many, many addresses and maps. And so the tour guide took us to the apartment building where my grandmother grew up, the house where my father and his parents and sisters grew up, lived, the school they went to, you know. So it was, just overwhelming because I was imagining my dad walking up these stairs, you know, walking up from the living room, up the stairs to the bedrooms, walking in the halls of the school, things like that. It was absolutely overwhelming. It was a personal, very, very personal for me there. I think that anybody who goes back to a family home like that might feel, in other words, it had nothing to do with the Holocaust. It had to do with, this is where my dad lived. And the family that lived there were absolutely wonderful. The couple that lived there, they invited us in for homemade brandy and desserts. Yeah, more Polish dessert. Can't have enough of them. And, you know, and we stayed and we talked to our guide who was the interpreter. And I continued to have a bit of an email correspondence with their daughter-in-law for a while. And she sent us some tiles, old tiles from the house that, you know, it kind of petered out as these things do. But for a while we did.
And let's talk a little bit about an author's life, in particular marketing, because the industry has changed a lot since your first book was published.
Yes. And this goes back to my first nonfiction book, in fact, which was The Merc Juggernaut, was published in 2003, I think. And the John Wiley, the biggest nonfiction, the biggest business book publisher in the country. And even back then, they said, most of the marketing is up to you. Yeah, you'll hear this from other authors. And so when you have a small press like I do, it's even the bigger burden on you. Well, yeah, that's being my first novel. Also, all the other outlets that I'd gotten used to using, many of them were not feasible anymore. On the other hand, because of the strong theme of second generation Holocaust guilt and the Jewish themes, a whole lot of avenues of Jewish groups opened up. And book groups, most book groups read fiction, So that also was a whole new world. So, you know, but yeah, absolutely. It's, you have to do so much marketing, you know. I love doing book talks and events. So, but I don't love setting them up and reaching out and, you know, all of that.
Yeah, I must say, I miss the good old days when we went to book fairs and met our readers, because there's nothing better than building a relationship with a reader. It's just wonderful. It's magic. And hopefully soon we'll be able to get back to that. Are you currently working on another novel?
Yes, and my agent will soon be submitting it to publishers. So fingers crossed, I don't want to jinx it. I won't tell you a thing about it. That would be jinxing it. But just that I'm thrilled. She's tough. She kept sending it back to me. It's not good enough.
Well, I guess that's her job too, like an editor. And how did you find your agent?
So it all begins in my synagogue. I was always the one spearheading, you know, environmental things. Why do we use paper cups? Can't we, you know, and I bought a bunch of ceramic mugs, you know, this and that sort of thing, you know. So if you remember the First People's Climate March, Obama was still president. Anyway, so my rabbi looks at me and says, Fran, would you be our liaison to the People's Climate March? Well, when your rabbi looks at you, okay. I go to a meeting, bunch of other liaisons of faith groups, you know, and there's a fellow there who's an editor of a Jewish magazine, and we're talking. And I said, do you ever run book excerpts? And he said, oh, sure. And I said, fiction? He goes, yeah. Because I had, my nonfiction book had been excerpted in other magazines. So meeting that editor at that meeting inspired me to say, well, maybe I can submit a section of my novel to other magazines. And there was one editor, indeed, fiction editor of a magazine who loved it. She wanted to publish it. Now, it didn't make it through the whole board of editors, but she turned out to become a real friend and a real mentor to me. And so I had kind of the chutzpah to ask her, say, you know, since you like my book so much, would you recommend it to your agent? And she said, well, she was actually starting with a new agent. And until that agent actually sold a book of hers, she would not feel right recommending anyone else, which makes total sense. But she said she knew someone else who was an agent, not her agent. And she would refer me to that person. And that was my agent, Sophia Seidner at Jill Grinsberg Literary Agency. Put in a plug for Sophia. She has become a friend. We really enjoy each other. And she is a tough editor, too. I mean, with my newest novel, she kept sending it back to me. It's not good enough. She had faith in me, you know, and she said, I said, you're going to stick with me. She goes, yes, I know you're a good writer. You can do it. And so that when she finally said, yes, it's good enough, you know, that really meant something to me.
Well, she sounds like a wonderful agent. One final question, Fran, what is one book, apart from one of your own, you'd like to see more people reading?
I mean, there are so many that I love. If a person's only going to read one book, it really should be one of the great classics, I guess. And my upbringing, you know, it was in the era of, you know, the white men. Those were the classics, a few white women in there. So I'm probably slighting great writers out there, great dead writers out there. I'm certainly slighting the living ones, because I said, if you're going to really just have one, I do think it should be one that's really, really stood the test of time. And I am just, in essence, influenced by the fact that I recently reread Anna Karenina, which is amazing. So I'd say, okay, read that. But that's kind of unfair, because it's, you know, I mean, if I had recently read it and it was terrible, I wouldn't say so. But it just made me see, my God, why? This is why he's a great, why Tolstoy is a master. From the very first sentence in the description of the waiter, this, all the care that goes into describing a waiter that you're never going to see again. Waiter doesn't hook you, but the fact that we know he's going to paint this incredible detailed world. And then the description of the, you know, the sibling relationships and the marital relationships that are already on the first page.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story. Fran, thank you so much for being with me today and chatting about your books, your nonfiction books. I wish you all the best with the airs and with your up-and-coming manuscript.
Thank you. I loved it.
Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Bookshop Podcast, or you can follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or on my website, mandyjacksonbeverly.com. See you around the corner.